criticize. I feel I'm nothing in your eyes. It makes me feel like giving up, because my best just ain't good enough. Girl, I want to provide for you and do all the things that you want me to. But
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right now.
From PTI, Worldwide Headquarters in Chicago, it's time for Stocks and Jocks.
Hello and welcome to Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom Howell. Jimmy Lawler on the board. SP Futures up 34. NASDAQ Futures up 205. Dow Futures up 123. So we're pretty close to being back to where we were before all this carnage began the other day. So let's see. If you wanted to make a real lot of dough and you were in power to do something, you would create some crisis with some crazy statement only after you and the people around you bought, like, puts and stuff. And then once we made a bunch of dough on those, you get rid of them and you say, oh, no, everything's okay, and you go back the other way. This is happening so often, it's hard to accuse anybody when you don't have any proof or evidence. But when you see it time after time, it's starting to be like, wow. Do we have Professor Lou?
So was that the animals I was listening to on the intro?
Yes, it was.
Yes.
Outstanding. Yeah. I got to compliment Jimmy on the selection
of
music.
Don't compliment Jimmy, because right to his head.
Well, I got to compliment Jimmy on the selection of music that I get to listen to when you guys are firing up. It was Sinatra last week, I think, or maybe Dean Martin, but the animals today. Very good. Thank you.
Who's the big chat in there?
Eric Burdon?
Burdon, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, who then, you know, he sings some fantastic, you know, some fantastic stuff, The House of the Rising Sun, some other major hits, and then he ends up with some group where he describes himself as, and singing a song where he describes himself as an overfed, long-haired, leaping gnome.
Oh yeah, that was him.
Hold the wine, yeah. Take that girl, or something like that. Just the stupidest thing, and I'm just going, dude, how far can you fall?
What band was that? Classic thing? That thing was a hit. That stupid song was a hit.
I guess. Ugh.
We had a
So I wanted to lead this morning with our sports story, which goes right to the heart of something you and I have been talking about, it seemed like every week, and that is what happens when a college football player decides that he signed a $4 million NIL deal and then decides he's exiting before the term of the contract expires. And this is playing out right now in Durham, North Carolina, in a very high-profile case involving Duke and the University of Miami. So the Duke quarterback, this kid named Mensa, has a $4 million, two-year, I think, deal with Duke, NIL deal. He
total for 4 years?
2 years.
Okay.
So he signed, on the last day of the portal, he notifies his coach that he's leaving. And Duke being Duke, which has a reasonably good law school, at least they did until they gave me a diploma from the place.
I thought you were the one to put their name on the map as a good law school.
Well, no, I don't think so. They immediately file a lawsuit in state court in North Carolina. Now, Duke's contract is pretty smart. They provide for arbitration. And arbitration agreements, an arbitration proceeding gives you a lot more kind of flexibility in terms of remedies than a normal court proceeding does. But when a player leaves, you want something that's enforceable. So they go into court initially to force this case into arbitration. But what they really want is an injunction to stop this kid from transferring. And they get an injunction, an initial preliminary, what's called a preliminary injunction, or in some cases a temporary restraining order. But this is a preliminary injunction with a hearing set for the beginning of February. And what the injunction said was, okay, kid, you can enter the transfer portal, but you cannot sign with another team, and you cannot accept an NIL contract with another club, with another college. So you're in the portal, but you can't do anything.
Are they still going to pay him?
Well, presumably yes, if he doesn't transfer. But this is a really interesting case, and just to show you that law professors are frequently wrong, and the so-called experts are frequently wrong. This is precisely what a legal sports law expert said could not happen in a podcast that I listened to 2 days earlier. So Duke's got a preliminary injunction, and my immediate reaction is, why on earth did they award and, you know, enjoin this kid from transferring? Because the remedy here, it seems to me, based on the NIL contract, is monetary. And you're not supposed to be able to get injunctions if the relief is purely monetary. So Duke has apparently argued that this is something more than a mere services contract, and that if this kid goes to Miami, they are going to be irreparably harmed, and that's the standard for an injunction, irreparable harm if this kid leaves and goes to play for somebody else.
Would you mind backing up here when you say, let's go back to the kids in high school?
Well, he was actually in college. He transferred in from someplace else.
Okay, so he's somewhere. He's Sidewash State. And Duke says, we're going to give you $2 million a year for 2 years.
Yep.
Now, the question is, Duke can't pay somebody $2 million, bucks, can they?
Sure they can.
I thought there were limits on that. You had to get an outside guy. You're saying that this contract was signed $2 million, where Duke gives this guy a check for $2 million divided by 50 every week, and the check is a.
Oh, I don't know how it's. I don't know the exact payment. I think the payment's made at the end of the season.
All right. So somehow.
But it's an NIL contract. So Duke may well have paid him the entire $4 million at this point.
All right. Whatever it is, it's the contract is with Duke. It's a 1099 deal. It's some sort of a consulting agreement. It's not a W-2. It's not an employee contract.
Nope. It's an NIL agreement.
Which is what?
Good question. So,
well, it can't be W-2 because you'd be an employee.
That's right. And Duke's not calling him an employee.
So no Social Security taken out, except He does. He has to pay it on his end. And
presumably, yes. This is a payment. Remember, this is an NIL payment for advertising and name, image, likeness rights that this kid is, that Duke is basically acting as a pass-through entity, because,
well, that's what I'm saying. Duke is not paying him. Some other people are. They just set it up,
or somebody is. Yeah, there's a fund.
Well, how much? But there is a number. What I'm trying to get to, there is a number where Duke can actually pay somebody.
Yes, there is.
Well, but it's not $2 million, I don't think.
I mean, Duke pays him based on the NIL fund that they've got established, and this is, you know, this is permissible. I mean, theoretically, Duke could gift him the money, but the NC2A regulates this stuff. So this is under the terms, I presume, of the House settlement.
Well, that's what Kevin was talking about yesterday, where he was saying that you can get, there's some number the school can actually pay people.
Right. That's $20 million a year.
And then there's another number that you can get from, what's the girl from Notre Dame with the Red Bull, but somebody has to say, well, she's actually doing a commercial for Red Bull, so
correct,
she's not getting paid.
Correct.
That, so we that don't know what part of this $4 million is in which camp for this kid.
Presumably, since the contract was signed in 2024, pre-House settlement, presumably it's going to fall under the $20 million and not an outside entity payment. So, okay. So because the outside entity payment has to be vetted.
So we think the only thing a kid has to do is play basketball for Duke. He doesn't have to do State Farm commercials or anything like that.
He's a football player, he's got to play football for Duke and remain academically eligible.
Assuming anybody goes to school anymore.
I don't know what the story is at Duke. Duke was pretty, I mean, historically, Duke has been pretty careful about that. They've required their athletes to go to class.
Notre Dame just grabbed like 8 or 9 high-end dudes out of the portal, and I wonder if the the admissions department is all over the phone call or it's just a coach. It's not like the old days where Dave Casper sat in class next to me.
I don't know. I mean, I will say this. I know, as of last year, I know the Duke basketball guys were going to class and we're sitting in class, so I assume the same rules apply for the football team. But I can't say for sure. But bottom line is, this is really interesting, because you put your finger immediately on the problem, because you're perceptive and you've talked to Kevin and me. Is this kid an employee? If he's an employee, see, enjoining somebody from going to another company or another school is the kind of thing you would do for an employee. You would claim irreparable harm because this guy is going with trade secrets or going with some kind of knowledge of your operation.
Well, he's going to a competitor for sure.
Or yeah, exactly. Going to a competitor, and this is going to irreparably harm you, because money won't compensate for what the damage is going to be done to your business. But that's if he's an employee. And this kid is not an employee. This kid has a service contract with a monetary, a monetary amount attached to it. And typically the remedy for a breach of a contract like that is money. And if it's money, in other words, he has to pay back some portion of the $4 million. If it's money, you don't get an injunction just if the damages are money, because that's not irreparable harm. You can be made whole.
Back up here on that. We're essentially talking about non-competes.
Yeah, sort of. It's something like it, yes.
Can you have a... I'll say this is a weird story. Where do I get my story? Anyway, I bought this Toyota T100, which you don't need to know about, from a guy in Miami, this Cuban guy. And nicest guys I've ever met. I look at him blue, and you don't usually look at guys, and you go, I'm going, all right, what does this guy do exactly? He's got forearms like Popeye. Turns out the dude leads young kids on martial arts stuff all over Europe from the Cuban community in Miami, right? And he's a consultant that works for, like, putting in a software systems. Now, my question is, if he said he was working at a 3-year job for like one of the oil companies, I don't know, it was Exxon or somebody. If Exxon gives you a 3-year job to put software in, can they enjoin you for not doing the same thing for Chevron the day you walk out of their place?
As an independent contractor? Yeah. Probably not.
Okay. So you were saying this isn't really like a non-compete like an employee would have then?
Well, an employee, an independent contractor is not an employee.
Okay.
Is an independent contractor. And the key, one of the key elements of being an independent contractor is that you can work for other people. Now, you can restrict the ability to use information. You can do, you know, trade secret protection typically, but you can't prohibit them from going to work for somebody else, and even while they're working for you. And but an employee is a different matter. Somebody coming into an employment relationship can, in most states, can be required to sign an agreement that says, I will not go work for a competitor within X number of months or a year or two, or within a particular geographic radius, depending on the business of the company. These things are narrowly construed, and they're usually interpreted in a way, you know, the language has to be interpreted. They're interpreted against the company that drafted it. But that's what's really unusual here, is that this injunction blocks this kid from going to another school.
Well, the thing that you're might be missing here, which I don't think you're missing, it's not unusual. There I was in the Tripoli Tap last night talking to my friend Bill, my attorney buddy, who's a massive Marquette fan because he went there and boxed for them and played football back when they had a football team. He says they've got three or four freshmen, one of whom I guess is going to be all Big East and somebody else is almost as good. And he goes, you know, they're looking for money for people. He goes, oh, somebody's going to grab these kids after this year and they're going to go. And he's like, you know, what's the point? It's exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, this hits home particularly for me because service academies, of course, can't even give them any money at all. And so, you know, and there's no military commitment at a service academy until you've been there 2 years. So if you have a promising, you know, sophomore who's a football player or a basketball player and shows some real promise, every Big Five school in the country is looking at those guys and saying, we can pick this kid up for nothing. We don't have to buy him out of his contract.
Well, didn't they realize that the one pitcher was so good, though, that they didn't really try and keep him, or they sort of tried
yes.
to keep him? But
yeah, Skeens. Yeah. Paul Skeens, kid that's pitching for Pittsburgh. Yeah, that's right. The academy athletic director and the baseball coach said, listen, kid, we get it that you want to be in the Air Force and help out the Air Force, but you're a once in a generation talent. You need to go somewhere else. But my point is that now we're at where the rubber meets the road with this Mensa kid. If he's an employee,
well, right now, what's he doing? Is he still in class at Duke?
I don't know.
Because if he's
probably
not. Because
if he's not
in the portal, he's got to be in class at Miami or something.
I presumably, yeah. So he may actually have enrolled at Miami. That's not clear yet. He may have enrolled in Miami, but he's got to, doesn't he? I mean, I've heard Kevin talk about this. He has to start class within a certain number of days, and you know the he's going to be stepping into. He had a pretty good year for Duke. He led him to the ACC championship. He effectively put Miami into the playoffs.
Yep.
Because if Duke had lost, it would have been Virginia going in. But he put Miami into the playoffs, and now Miami wants him as a QB. So again, the idea that you could stop him from playing is crazy to me because this is a monetary damages situation. He's not an employee. If he was an employee, you might be able to stop him. So this gets we're getting a real legal entanglement here. Now, Duke, you know, Duke may be trying
well,
to argue.
If I were to say to somebody, you know, they're going to pay me, somebody's got $1 billion and they want a money manager guy in house, and they said, okay, we want to hire you and a couple of people here at PTI that help you out. We're going to pay you guys, you know, $1 million a year to help us out with our $90 billion contract. This hasn't happened, by the way. But we want you to have a 2-year contract. I'm not so sure I can buzz out after 1 year and go somewhere else, can I?
No. Well, okay, short answer. If you're in a, are you hired as an employee?
Well, I'm hired as a allegedly a consultant, but the implication is it's fairly full time for three people.
Okay, well,
$90 bazillion.
If they hire you, let's say you're as a consultant, so you're coming in, let's say, as a contractor.
Yeah.
They hire you for this job and they pay you. However you get paid, and then you bolt. You could be sued for breach of contract, but they wouldn't be able to stop you from going to another job. You'd simply be sued for economic damages.
Okay. Because I'd pretty much have to promise them, 70% of my time or something. I mean, and all of a sudden they get 10, that's a problem.
Yeah, it is. It creates all kinds of problems. But the remedies under most states that I'm aware of would be a monetary remedy, we don't force people to work for other people if they don't want to, even if they've signed a contract. But the best we can do is stop people from going to work for other people if you can demonstrate, a need and an appropriate legal document. This gets tied up into one of your favorite subjects, restraint of trade.
Yeah.
And also under the 13th Amendment. This case is really interesting, and I raise it because it's on they've gotten an injunction now, and I'm unaware of anybody else that's gotten an injunction to stop somebody from actually transferring to another school. This is a first. I don't know if the injunction is going to hold up. I don't think it, under what I know about the case, I don't think it should.
To me, it's, if you just look at it, that's why, you and I look at things differently. That's why it's great to talk. I look at it and I go, okay, what's the cost to recruit some bump? It's probably, since none of these bleeps take Southwest Air anymore, Lou. Every place they go, they're taking a private jet. And what does it cost to recruit every kid? $200,000? $250,000? Somewhere in there. It might not be that high, but it's taking family members up to visit campus on a private jet. This isn't cheap.
Nope.
So it's $250,000 and you're 6'4" and you're 200 pounds. It looks like you're gonna fill out. You're fast as hell, and you need some. We need to feed you. You need to mature. You need to get some muscle. And 2 years from now, you're gonna be a All-American tight end or something. Okay, well, 2 years goes down the road. Now you're up to $70,000 tuition. That's not probably cost, but it's list. And now we're into you for 5 or 6, and now you're just going to go?
Yep.
There's got to be some clawback there someplace, I would think, just from an economic standpoint.
I would think so, but, we're a brave new world.
Well, think of it as a little, maybe they're not as old as me. It's not new. None of this is new. When I came out of business school,
well, it's new. It's new because it's out in the open.
Well, no, what I'm saying, the numbers aren't new.
The numbers have always been there, but this was always the cost of recruiting was factored into.
But everybody always thinks, especially people on the show, because we're all sports junkies, that somehow sports is different. I guess it is because we've
no,
made
it's
it different.
Not.
But when I got out of grad school, MBA school, I think my total cost of University of Chicago, I went in the summer, so I cut it down a little bit. Say it was $3,500, maybe $4,000. Total deal, 2 years. And I was more than that, maybe five. Any place you wanted to go, Pullman, Allied Van Lines, where I started, if you said I want to go take MBA at night, they just paid for it. They didn't give a crap. All of a sudden now it went from $5,000 to $10,000 to $15,000, and somebody goes, wait a minute. We're not going to have people walking out of here the day to get their degree. If we pay for it, you either got to stay a year or you got to give us half of it back. This has been going on in society forever.
I've drafted agreements like that myself.
Yeah. So now that this is the cost of making you, you're doing most of it yourself, but bringing you from cradle to someplace to where somebody else wants you is a cost, just like an MBA program. So it's no different, right?
Theoretically, yes.
So okay, if you bolt after 2 years and we're not paying you anything other than this stuff, we still have an investment in you.
We do, and if you can capture that in a contract, you can recover it.
Well, the ideal situation, which is every other place. Again, this isn't new. If you go play for the go watch a game with the Crestwood Riverhead or Thunderbolts, those guys they're one of these baseball teams that is not affiliated. The guy holds tryouts 2 days a week. They get people. They find guys that still can play, and maybe some guys that went to college and had to quit for somebody sick or whatever. They get guys out there, and they probably, I'll bet the guy has signed 50 people to major league contracts. I don't know if any of them made it to the majors. I'm going to say that the major league team buys the contract from the guy. Why shouldn't, if there's a big star at Slippery Rock and Duke wants him, why shouldn't Duke pay Slippery Rock for the guy? And say,
well, I think that's where this will ultimately end up. It'll be a buy. These will be buyout provisions. And if I was negotiating the contract for the kid, I would say I want a buyout provision in here so that if he gets a better offer, that he can buy out of this agreement and go.
Which would I rather have, some pimply phrased freshman that I'm feeding and doing God knows what with for 2 years till he can play, or I'd rather go grab him after his sophomore year? Then dog.
Well, that's yeah. That there are. You know, that's the Deion Sanders model.
Yeah.
Which is we're not recruiting freshmen. I mean, we might get a couple in here for whatever, but our big move is going to be bringing kids in from from other programs. Well, I mean, that's what Cignetti did at Indiana, except he did it with 2 and 3 star recruits instead of 4 and 5 star recruits.
Well, how does Kevin was going to look into it, and I'm sure he will tomorrow.
And by the way, if you ever doubted the impact of a successful college program on your school and its alumni fundraising, take a look at what's happened in Indiana. And I flew into Indianapolis last weekend, and I came into the airport on a Saturday morning. I walk into the gate area, flying Southwest, walk into the gate area, and there, Southwest had flights apparently leaving out of that.
Is that what they call your private jet firm, Southwest?
Yeah, that's right. Southwest had flights leaving for Miami International, Fort Lauderdale, a couple of other airports in Orlando. It was a sea of red.
Oh, yeah.
I have never seen so much red in my life. And the whole area, waiting area, was full of it. They had, like, I think, 3 or 4 flights.
Well, that's your buddy Mark Cuban ponied up for Ebony's students.
That's exactly right. And so we're not ever going to argue about the impact, the economic impact of a successful college program in a high value or high visibility sport ever again.
I'll be happy to make that argument.
Okay.
And I would still win.
Okay. I think you don't, but in any event, it was tremendous. And I went up, I drove from Indianapolis up toward Chicago. I had meeting a relative. And I mean, everywhere I stopped, every gas station, every whatever, solid red.
Oh, I think they're really into it. You know what? The Triple E's become a kind of a little Indiana bar. People are nice as hell. It's a great group.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's not like the Boston people. God, whatever. But no, it's a really nice group. I was pulling for my. How do we get to a 24-year-old average age?
At that football team?
Yeah.
Easily. There's no limits now on very few limits on people being able to play in the NC2A. You just got to be a student.
Okay, so what's the formula? You got to get some bozo like Cuban who has to keep himself on TV, however he does it, to spread his money around. And you need a coach that goes against these guys. You need... What exactly are these guys doing at age 20? Well, if the average is 24, there's got to be a couple guys that are 26. What are they doing?
What do you mean, what do they do? They go to
PhD
class.
Students? Are they non-students? Where are they?
Some are grad students. Some of them go to class. I mean, that's pretty loose as to what constitutes a student affiliation.
That's what I mean.
You're going to see this. I think you're about to see this.
I'm feeling for where the end game is here, because I don't know where it is. I'm hoping you do.
I don't predict that stuff anymore. You're about to see this, by the way, start to play out in a big way, I think, at Northwestern, which has plenty of money and a brand new stadium and is just itching to be the next Indiana.
Why is the... Somebody wrote into a Quora the other day about, has there ever been a school that, you know, guy gave up on football and is doing just fine? And the guy talked about University of Chicago's got like more Nobel Prize winners, and they get just as big of a endowment. And why, if you look at what Northwestern does, other than I guess some ego along the line, this is a pimple on the ass of their budget, for God's sake. Is it just ego? Why do they care?
Sure, it's ego.
Well, I mean,
why do mayors fight to keep NFL teams in when and sign terrible deals for stadiums? Why is Chicago in an uproar? Because the Bears are going to move to Northwest Indiana?
They're not really in an uproar. I'm not in an uproar at all.
Well, I mean, there was some uproar. I flew back from Indianapolis with a bunch of Chicago people. I don't know why there were a bunch of Chicago people on the airplane headed to Denver, but a bunch of Chicago Bears fans on the airplane watching that game, which, by the way, Starlink is cosmic.
Really?
What it's doing for airplanes and their Wi-Fi systems is unbelievable.
Well, good for them.
People are watching the game in real time on their phones and their laptops. And by the way, wonderful group of people. We were all talking about the Bears and what was going on with the game. And just as we were landing is when Williams threw that pass off his back foot 60 yards into the end zone. And this roar goes out of the inside of the aircraft, and I thought I'd been dozing, and this roar goes out of the crowd. I thought we'd blown an engine up or something, but anyway, an aside.
What did that deep back? The deep back was all over Command. He just wandered away. Did he think that Williams was down or something?
I you know, your perspective is hard, but when you see the quarterback running backwards, you know, 20 yards, I think you start thinking he's never going to get it to this guy. I got to worry about a throw in front of me,
probably
where they're going to get the first down or some stupid thing's going to happen. I suspect that's what happened.
Well, I hope this coach, who appears to have a lot of good things coming for him, I hope he doesn't turn into another Dan Campbell,
the Indianapolis coach, or who?
Detroit.
Oh, okay.
Because that guy is. If I were to grade him,
who doesn't turn into Dan Campbell?
The Bear guy,
the Bear coach. Okay, got it.
And if I were to grade Dan Campbell, I would say an incredible leader of men, knows talent, knows football. He could be the worst game coach I've ever seen. High school, college, or what? This passion for going on fourth down instead of taking 3 points, especially early in the game, is insanity. The Bears could have won that game easy if the guy would have taken those first two field goals.
I wondered about that myself. That would have won the game for him.
In weather like that, you got points. You better get them, bud.
Yeah, you know, I was thinking about that. The Vikings, and then I want to talk. If you want to talk a little bit about what it means to with these coaching changes, and
well,
and the impact
of
that.
Very quick story about Gary and state and stadiums.
Go.
You can imagine me doing something like this a little bit. I had a issue with one of my trucks, and I drove it into this service thing, Goodyear place. They were real nice to me. They aligned it. They did whatever I needed done. So me, the next time I needed a set of tires, I felt obligated to go buy tires from these guys, right? So I go in, and I'm waiting, and they're putting the tires on, and there's another dude in the lobby. All of a sudden, this very well-dressed African-American man comes and sits down, and he's got all these drawings, you know, rolled up white pieces of paper, and all of a sudden he's spreading them out on one of these tables, and he's doing stuff, and the guy goes, "Hey, you like work for the city?" And the guy's a little, "Duh, yeah," and he's a engineer. Somehow the guy gets on the subject of the stadium there for the Gary Railcats, right? When you can see it from the tollway, it's a really nice.
That's
minority.
A great. That's a beautiful baseball stadium.
Yeah. Well, the guy says this thing was a horse bleep deal, and the guy goes, "What are you talking about?" He says, "The owners went to all the..." This is a black guy saying this. "The owners went to all the preachers, got all the support for this place, for the Gary to put up all this money. You know, the kids are going to go see it. They're going to all become baseball players. You know, it's going to be a money maker." He goes, "The thing's a beautiful stadium." He goes, "The thing is a big hole of money." He goes, "Not only that, somehow it's under the water table, so they have to have a pump underneath to constantly pump water out of the place or it won't flood. And he goes, we pay for that. He goes, this thing has been a cash hole for the city of Gary since day one. Now, knowing that, now they're going to build a Bears stadium? I mean, duh. But, you know, the weird part of this, Lou, I mean, you're kind of into politics, but, you know, you're a Colorado guy. But if so many people make money on these stadiums, the only people that are screwed are you and me. I mean, if you put one of these places up, that's what Jerry Reinsdorf, his kids, at least one of them, maybe two, are in. If there's a stadium built pretty much anywhere in North America, maybe even in the world, they are a part of it. They have a stadium consulting firm, and they're going to come away with some soccer stadium in Mexico with the security contract, with the cleaning the bathroom contract. Everybody at these places makes dough, except the people who own the place, which is the citizens. They get screwed every time. And it's, I don't know why people don't understand this. If they put a new stadium up here and you and I get to get the camera contract and the wherever the cameras are going to go for security, we're going to make money for 20 years. We'll never have to work a day in our life. Or if we're a group that cleans the bathrooms as much as we really don't want to do that, never have to work a day. So the idea that like nobody makes money here is so screwed up, it's scary. But you got to be one of those guys.
You got to be one of the inside people.
Yeah. All right, go ahead. Sorry to interrupt.
Well, no. So I was going to just say that when you were talking about the field conditions and going for it, it harkens back to the Vikings versus the Rams in the divisional playoffs in 1977, I believe. It had poured rain in L.A. for like 4 days straight. They're playing in the Rose Bowl. It had poured rain for like 7 days straight. They get out onto the field, and the field is so muddy and soupy that, you know, my father goes to Bud and said, listen, we're not going to be able to throw in this for very long, and my guys, you know, the whole pass protection thing is going to go to pieces, because nobody's going to be able to get any footing. The receivers aren't going to be able to make their cuts. So if we're going to throw, let's throw early before the field goes completely away. Which was unusual, because my father always preferred to run the football for his people. And so, you know, the coaches huddle on this and they decide that's what they're going to do. And so they threw like, you know, 25 passes, and then that was it. The field had just disintegrated. You couldn't read the numbers. You know, Pat Hayden was the quarterback for the Rams. Bob Lee, I think, was the quarterback for the Vikings. You couldn't read the numbers on the jerseys. You couldn't see the line markings. The in middle of the field was just a giant mud puddle, and it was a terrible, awful football game to watch after the first quarter, because nobody could do anything. You know, it's one of those deals where you see the guys running in the film, you see the guys running, and you see the splashes of mud. You know,
well, Salt Lake Field must be in pretty good shape, because neither receivers on either team could get any space from the defenders. Usually, it's a big advantage for the offensive guy. And really
all the passes were short because the ball was soaked. All the passes were short passes, and after that, nobody could throw, and it just disintegrated. And so that, again, taking into effect count field conditions, you say, look, let's, you know, nobody's going to be scoring a lot here. We're not going to be able to do a lot here, so let's do this. And that, I mean, they won the game. It was a huge upset. LA was favored by, I think, 10 points, but they won the football game, and that was a big part of the strategy. I think they got 10 points on the board with able to throw the football, and then they just hunkered down and did their stuff.
Oh yeah, I met Pat Hayden one night on an elevator of all places.
Smart guy.
Yeah, very nice guy. And for the minute I met him, I get on this elevator and two guys are getting awards that night, Notre Dame Club of Chicago. It's Pat Hayden and Paul Harnick. I will get on the elevator, and there's the two of those guys, and then there's me. Well, Paul Horney was always Mr. Sandbagger. He's supposed to be, what, 6'2", 220 or something. Hayden's supposed to be 5'11", you know, whatever. Well, at the time, I was 6'4". Horning's bigger than me. He's a huge man. Pat Hayden comes up to butt my nose. I mean, he was probably 5'10 on a bad day. And I'm sitting there going, these two guys look like Mutt and Jeff. If you look at their stats, they're like almost even. They were Paul Harney's a big guy. I mean,
That's like the first time I got stood next to Joe Montana, and I just remember thinking that this guy is the most unlikely looking quarterback you've ever seen in your life. Anyway, the other thing I wanted to just discuss. Well, first of all, I hope you all are dressing warm there today. I can't believe those temperatures. So good luck.
It's not going to be minus 20, but it's minus 13 is pretty bad.
Yeah, minus 13 is bad enough in Chicago. It's going to be where my family, my sister and brother live up in Minneapolis. It's going to be like minus 25.
Oh, God.
So that'll be
that's,
cold.
You know, that's pipes blowing. It's dangerous there.
Yeah, but that's. I mean, they're used to it up there. At least where it's going to be a real problem, and I think you can never prepare for this, is the ice storm that's coming to the Texas and the Southeast, and that's going to be a disaster. If they get half inch to quart to an inch of ice on everything, it'll take down power lines and everything else, and that's just going to be a mess.
Hey, would you mind? There was a guy on. All the stuff going on with Greenland. They had this guy from Denmark. I don't know what he was in. One of their I think he was an elected official. And he was talking about, now, of course, you never get any of this through our news, one side or the other. He said, the U.S. had 30 bases here at one time. And he goes, they're down to one. He goes, we didn't kick anybody out. You guys left. If you want them back, just ask. What are you doing all this stuff for? I'm sitting there going, I don't know. What are we? He goes, if you want to, they're still there. If you want to go repopulate them again, go ahead.
I think this is one of these situations where you have literally a jumble of potential very good reasons to be there. I'm not sure that any of them are exactly the reason that's the motivation. I think some of this might be related to Golden Dome.
I think some of it is related to a kleptocracy.
Maybe that too. But I mean, I'm not thrilled about the way the diplomacy has been working so far. But it seems to be working. I mean, you now have the NATO chief, who has said, we want the U.S. in there, and we need the U.S. in there, and let's make this happen.
We are in there. We've always been in there.
I think our people want to be in there in a specific way with effectively sovereignty over whatever area we're going to be in.
Are you going to benefit from Trump's mineral rights deal?
I don't know what the mineral deal is.
He wants his piece of the action. He always seems to have.
Well,
his buddy Singer got all the oil from Venezuela, the first tankers.
Okay, so those tanker, that oil had to go somewhere. It wasn't going to go to us, to the government. The government can't refine it. Right. And those tankers were properly seized because they were under false flags.
This is the stuff that actually is coming from Venezuela.
No, I haven't seen us get anything that's actually coming from Venezuela.
Yeah, they are exporting some stuff. I mean,
they're exporting some stuff. The oil that we've seized, as far as I know, the oil that we've seized has all been on these false flag tankers.
Well, okay, but there's also, I think, a couple of, wherever it was, the first tranche of oil, well, that's where it's going to go, because he owns the refineries that he just happened to buy a week before this happened. He owns the refineries that can refine.
They can process the heavy sulfur. Yeah,
it's got to go. So it's not. I don't bitch with that.
I'm sure that there is discussion about that. I haven't seen anything about the minerals. As far as I know, we don't have a deal yet for that. The development costs for that are going to be astronomical. So I don't know what the arrangement's going to be for that. And I'm sort of holding my breath. I know that we backed off the tariffs for Europe yesterday on the claim that we have a framework that needs to be fleshed out, but that will ultimately result in giving us whatever it is we want in terms of, as I said, I think something like sovereign control over portions of or all of Greenland for purposes of, and like I said, there are multiple reasons here, for purposes of national defense, for purposes of basing, for purposes of development, for purposes of the missile defense system, for purposes of anti-submarine warfare.
But the part is, it's not ours. There's all kinds of reasons for us to own a chunk of China, too. Are we going to get that?
Well, I mean, it's not ours, but you know, from our perspective, we've defended it and we need it. So let's sell it to us.
Well, you know, I don't think you're a guy who's into the way that we do diplomacy, but I get this thing from Quora Digest yesterday, and somewhere along the line, Mr. Runoff from his mouth president said something about Denmark didn't do squat in World War II or something. I don't know, whatever he was talking about.
That's basically true.
So this guy writes into Quora, and he's got a picture there of evidently his father. This guy must be older. His father was a special forces guy for Denmark and all the different places he did and all the raids they did on the Nazis and stuff. And he goes, here's this draft dodger calling my dad basically a pussy. The dude insults people. I mean,
he does. I'm not a fan. I've told you. And I'll say it again. He reminds me of my absolute worst clients. But you know, I understand why we want Greenland and why we want some level of sovereignty over the place. And you know, I admit he's gone about it in a way that I would not have gone about it.
What do you think a direct approach would have been? Look, my guys tell me. And you guys probably agree because they talk all the time. This has to be part of this Golden Dome thing. And oh, by the way, the Russians are all over this Arctic stuff, and the Chinese too. We all need Greenland as a strategic spot. Let's do it. I don't think anybody has a problem with that. I don't.
I don't either. And I would have just said, look, you guys have long said, this is to the Danes. You have long said that the residents of Greenland should determine their future. We're going to give you, we're going to pay you $450 billion for Greenland. That, by the way, wipes out your national debt. It's enough to give everybody in Greenland, you know, $500,000. And we'll put it to, that's the offer. We'll put it to a referendum.
Okay, but why, when we had 30 bases there, we didn't have to own it? Yeah, we actually sort of did. Why do we all of a sudden, is this just his personality or what?
Because when, I don't know, but when we had 30 bases there, Denmark didn't exist as a country. It was occupied by the Nazis. And the Danish ambassador or Danish government in exile, whatever that was, gave us permission to have unfettered use of the place. So I think what we want is something comparable to that, and we don't have it right now.
But it's never really been pulled back, has it? We've never kicked out.
We were kicked out, but the people that live up there have some say in what's going on right now, and you know, they can. There have been demonstrations against our basing, and some bad decisions with respect to awarding contracts to Chinese companies going in there and drilling through the ice cap. So we want the ability to control that as a matter of national security. At least that's one reason.
And I actually don't have a kind of an issue. I think this could have been done really easily without insulting the hell everybody.
I agree with you. I know we're not supposed to agree with each other. No. I agree with you. I don't like how it was done. I don't like what's going to happen. I don't like the bombast and this, you know, whatever else was going on. And I think it's ridiculous.
Well, what do you think? What do you think when we talk about war and economy?
I mean, Tom, we've talked about this guy being a chaos agent.
Yeah,
from day one.
Well, let's forget about him for a second. In terms of wars and economies, it can work two ways. I mean, you can look at a place like Russia, which obviously economically is getting their ass kicked. Did they ever get their their rail cars fixed that you talked to me about?
China has a problem, and their economy is having serious problems.
I don't know what
they're actually able to produce right now. They're buying most of their war material from North Korea and China,
Jesus.
And Iran.
Well, I mean, but China's not in the best of shape, and I guess I'm back to them.
China's doing pretty well,
but we have a guy who's given Europe all kinds of shit. We owe him like $3 trillion. I mean, it's not like we're a debtor nation too. I mean, now that either can cause people to say, "What are we doing on all this war materials?" or it can make people more desperate. Where do you think we are on that scale?
In terms of provoking a reaction out of Europe?
Well, I mean, you wouldn't think Russia would be looking to go fight five wars, but it sure looks like they're undeterred.
Russia is exactly looking at going to fight five wars, and in fact has made aggressive moves along the border with Finland and along the border of the Baltic states.
What do they got left?
I know. Well, they got enough. They got people left, apparently, and they've got enough left to be able to say we are credibly threatening, you know, NATO. We want to fracture NATO. We're credibly threatening it.
Well, and they're working on one side, and Trump's working on the other.
You know, Trump. So, again, I defer to the NATO chief, who said. And somebody else at
Davos. By the way, who's the NATO chief? How does he get that job?
Rutke, he's Belgian, I think.
Okay.
Who said, you know, unabashedly, listen, it's a darn good thing that you know Donald Trump came along, because we would not have had, and I don't know if it's Rutke's the guy that said it's a good thing Trump came along, and it's a good thing the United States is pushing the way it's pushing because we need this. I can't remember who it was, the head of another state. It may have been one of the British guys who said, listen, without Donald Trump, we would not be at 2%. We would not be contemplating 5% of our investment in national defense. We would have motored along, relying on the United States to carry our water and basically telling ourselves they'll be here if things happen. And so we don't have to spend money on this. And the truth of the matter is we do. And we're faced with a very real threat from Russia and from China, and we have to deal with that. And we wouldn't be dealing with it if this guy hadn't gone into the White House.
You're always going to find guys in the armed forces that anybody who gives them more money to spend, they're going to be happy.
Well, I mean, you could say that. I mean, I'm the NATO head is.
Is there any connection between the NATO head and the European Central Union head? The guys in Belgium, or are they totally separate?
They're separate, but I won't say interleaved, but they're separate, but they consult.
I mean, a big, huge colossus of people, the Parliament in Belgium, it's the European Union. They don't control NATO. NATO's different.
No, right? they don't control NATO. But NATO, the reporting lines for NATO are directly to the heads of various governments.
Okay.
But the short answer is that there's a recognition that you know, the EU needed a big push on this. And for all the wailing and gnashing of teeth and rending of garments and, you know, sackcloth, ashes, all that's going on over there, I think this what the president and his foreign policy people, Rubio and the rest of them, are trying to do
is
shock therapy.
We needed the big push here.
I'm sorry?
We still need the big push here.
In terms of?
Military stuff.
Yes, and we are.
Yeah, well, I'm saying... We caught wind and they're kind of going. I mean, it wasn't like we were the only people 10 years ago that were doing this kind of stuff. We weren't.
Actually, Trump was the one of the major criticisms of Trump early on was when he went to Europe and said, "Listen, you guys got to start picking up your share of the load." And no American president had said that in that way publicly for decades.
Because
there's always been a push to get them to do it, but they ignored it.
But
was the first guy who said, listen, I'm going to back out of this if you don't start paying
your
bills.
I'm always going to disagree with this one because, not disagree, but if Germany in 1955 would have said, we're going to start spending 20% of our national stuff on war stuff, we wanted to be in control.
We actually forced the rest of NATO to allow German rearmament.
Yeah, what I'm saying is, the only time we wanted something is if we were going to go invade Iraq a couple of times, the British came with us, and a bunch of guys came with us. We talked them into it, but we weren't all that upset with them not doing stuff. We liked having people in Europe.
And that worked, and we agreed with that, and we allowed that for the first 40 years.
Yeah,
but after 1991. We started going back to them and saying, you need to pick up more. You know, we don't have an immediate threat on your Eastern Front. You need this. Now is the time to modernize. Now is the time to pick up your obligations and start, you know, playing ball with us. Your economies have recovered. Let's go.
I think that it also corresponded with us being broke.
With what?
Us being broke. borrowing money that would start in the 90s.
Well, I that may be the case, but the short answer was we were competing with these economies now. They were able to compete with us internationally, and we looked around and said, how come we're still paying for your defense? You're diverting all this money into your social welfare programs, and we get that. But now it's time. You're on your feet now. Let's go. Pick up more of it. And they didn't do it. They weren't willing to hear it. Trump was the first guy in 2015 to basically say, if you guys don't start doing this right and following your treaty obligations, I'm gonna get us out of here.
I don't really have any problem with somebody sort of recognizing that, but the whole progression of it and how it happened and when it started when we had all kinds of money here, we didn't care. We wanted to be in control of the world.
We did, and we wanted, you know, NATO was a U.S. organization, just like Warsaw Pact was a Soviet organization through the 80s. And we guaranteed the security of Europe with our blood and treasure through the 80s. And when the 90s rolled around and these economies started competing with us, we looked around and said, why are we paying this load? These guys can pay. And what's really interesting, Tom, is that their defense capabilities were actually not bad in the 1980s and 1990s. They started to go downhill in the 90s.
They actually helped us out quite a bit in Gulf 1 and 2, right?
Yeah, but they've gone, that represented a huge portion of their defense capability, and it was quite limited in terms of actual support. By the mid-teens, when you and I first raised this, the Luftwaffe, I've mentioned this before, Luftwaffe had less than 100 100 operational fighters. The British Army had one battalion of main battle tanks that was functioning.
I'm with you, and all this, we're not supposed to agree. But look at the Japan situation, and we didn't want, we liked our bases over there.
The Japanese Constitution,
okay,
which MacArthur wrote, right, had a provision in it that said they could not engage in the development or purchase of weapons that could be used offensively.
Okay, I understand that.
And their military, and that's only changed recently.
There's one thing to say, and it's style points, I understand this. It's one thing to say we were very happy doing all that stuff over in Okinawa and all those other places. All of a sudden, one day, we don't have any money, and China starts rattling a saber. It's one thing to say, maybe we should change this constitution. It's quite another to say, hey, you assholes aren't helping.
I don't like the second way,
I guess what I'm saying.
Well, we didn't couch it to the Japanese that way. And the Japanese, are not members of NATO, so it wasn't a treaty obligation. We sat down with the Japanese and said, listen, you guys know who the bad guys are here, and they're coming for you. And you're gonna be dish number one on the menu if the balloon goes
without
up
a doubt.
Here.
Without a doubt.
Or dish number two. Taiwan's dish number one. And so they're gonna be coming for you. So let's start joint training a lot, which we did, and then let's start joint weapons development, which we did. And oh, by the way, all these bases that we have over here, let's start integrating more with you guys on these bases.
I'm 100% agreeing with that.
And that's what we did with Japan. That was starting when I was in Okinawa in the mid 80s. But it's really
so
picked
were
up.
Were they coming up? Sorry, but were they coming up absolutely from zero? I mean, if somewhere along the line they bought their first submarine from Australia. How'd they learn how to run?
They had all those tanks and airplanes that attacked Godzilla. So they had a military capability. They had to fight off the kaiju.
Right, who was the star in that movie?
Godzilla.
Well, Raymond Burr.
Well, they dubbed Raymond Burr in there for American audiences when they released the film here. But my point is they had a limited capability. They had some very technically competent weapon systems, but they were very limited in their capability because of their constitutional limits. That's been lifted. They are now developing, again, with U.S. help, with U.S. technology, but it's the same kind of thing we do with Israel. you know, we allow them to joint develop weapons with our companies using some of our technology, and we reap the benefits from that. The Japanese have an operational railgun on at least one of their destroyers, really? Something we don't have.
Well, one that are building the subs everybody was fighting over, is it them or the Aussies? Somebody was building subs for somebody, and then they ended up, one of them got the contract. They were fighting.
Oh, the French. The Australians were buying submarines from the French, and we came in and said, you don't want those crappy French boats. We'll give you nukes, nuclear subs.
Well, the Japanese.
But the Japanese have developed some very competent oxygenated submarines that can run submerged for quite a while.
Hey, you know,
that are very quiet.
Did you, this is this weird stuff when you end up driving around during the day. I had to go to a funeral yesterday or a wake. Have you heard of this? This is sort of off topic, but I guess it's on sports. This guy who has a, you know, whatever, everybody's got a stupid website or whatever. His 6-year-old daughter has been picking games, playoff games for the football.
No.
The 6-year-old daughter that knows nothing about football. Evidently, she had this big record going into last week, and she was 0 for 6. The kid is getting death threats because idiots actually bet based on her. Do we need to have everyone in this country get a job and do 8 hours, something for 8 hours during the day where they don't sit there and do this kind of stuff?
I don't know, but that's that. A doesn't surprise me, and B, it's crazy.
We got a couple minutes. I mean, our guys will be listening, but.
Well, I can see Wayne and Andrew waiting right now.
They always like.
You got to kick me off.
No, well, give them a minute or two because they always like continuing on what we're talking about. Every place I go now, I mean, you know, Audrey has a bunch of friends. Does everybody know at least one or two families where somebody is at home age 30 to 35, maybe never had a job, that listens to right or left wing TV all day long and doesn't do anything? What is with these people? I mean, what are we doing as a society? For God's sake, how do you not do anything all day?
I don't know anybody like that, but my understanding is
ask around.
That's where most of the demonstrators in Minneapolis are coming from, is my understanding.
Oh, God. Well, everybody has to denigrate whoever that is.
That's right.
One of the guys in the Tripoli. Now, you never thought of this, Lou, because, you know, he's 78, 79, he goes, I want to go to this, the next No Kings thing. I went to the last one. And I said, okay. And he's like an old biker hippie kind of guy. And he goes, the only problem is, when you get to be 78, you got to go to the bathroom every once in a while. And nobody will let you in if you're a protester. I go, why don't you go out, see if you can find somebody who will make you a sandwich sign, and just let it go. Nobody will know, because you're covered on both sides. He goes, that's not a bad idea. I didn't realize that nobody will let you in if you're a demonstrator to use the bathroom. I guess everybody has a problem.
Interesting. That, I guess that's one way of dealing with it. bathroom boycotts.
What have you ever seen? I haven't seen a sandwich sign in ages. Have you? Everybody says poster.
No, that's only sandwich signs I've seen have been stationary. You know, parked outside places.
That was
not on somebody.
Well, that was a work. If you had to carry that thing all day long, you actually had to work to be a demonstrator. You'd be in shape. So no, you still guys got no snow, eh?
We're gonna get some this weekend, but no, it's they're not doing well.
Does that mean Lake Mead's going down again?
Yep, I think so.
All right, bud. Well, thank you. Good stuff. We'll see what the world gives us next week, eh?
All right. You guys talk to you. Stay warm, Tom.
We will. SP Futures up 40, Nasdaq Futures up 236. Do we have our guys?
Yes, we do.
Guys, how are you? We talking about some.
I'm good. I enjoyed listening to that reference about Godzilla. I when I was in the Navy, I was over in Yokosuka, which is on Tokyo Bay. And one thing about many Japanese, at least it was back in, this was a case in the 80s, they all wanted to practice their English. So people, strangers would just come up, notice you were an American, and just start having a conversation. And I was looking out over Tokyo Bay from this really nice walkway in Yokosuka, where the U.S. Navy is based, and this Japanese guy came up and he started talking, and I said to him, I said, you know, I'm very impressed how you guys cleaned this whole place up. And he looked at me, he said, what do you mean? I said, well, geez, you know, Godzilla came through here and really trashed the place back in the early 50s. And this guy was looking at me like, I was from some other planet. And I just got thinking, I bet at every family reunion, that encounter comes up where he says, yeah, I ever tell you about the crazy American that.
He's like the number one monster of all time, isn't he?
Yeah, he's got a staying power too.
Yeah, well, it's
that was all the purpose of the movie was to show the dangers of radiation, of course, from the bombs we dropped in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and so that was supposed to be some sort of cautionary film about the dangers.
Well, did you guys ever? I could see. Little conspiracy guys. did you ever watch the X-Files?
Oh yeah, loved it.
The last show or two, and I don't know where the hell they got these films. They had films of people after the thing in Hiroshima. I don't know how they got them on a TV show, but they showed like a wall where the thing went off on one side, and the light came by, and you'd see.
The shadow people
and then they all these people going to the doctor with no eyebrows, no eyelashes, and no hair.
Oh, yeah.
How did they get that stuff out of classified for a TV show?
You know the Pentagon has worked closely with Hollywood for years. I think they still have an office out there, as does the CIA, and they help. Help some of these movie production companies, and of course they get their whatever propaganda they want, in the movies. So yeah, I'm sure that they had no problem.
I never see that thing on reruns. There was some creepy stuff on that show.
Absolutely. It's a lot of it is based on, not only popular culture, but there was a lot of references to Project Blue Book and, things the government was actually involved in.
Andrew, I was thinking of you pretty dramatically yesterday. Somebody sent me this thing regarding Trump's 75-minute speech yesterday, which was kind of really something. And also the part about the thing he sent to Norway, where you didn't give me the Peace Prize, you're gonna see what that means now or something along those lines. And on one side of the page was all the reaction from, I'll say, the left, and the other side was all the reaction from the right. And you were talking last week about talking to two different people about what's going on. It was like two different worlds. The one side, they go, if they don't have a psychologist talking to the people in the cabinet right now, the man's mentally unstable. On the other side, see what a great leader he is? I mean, it is like people watched absolutely two separate movies. And it's pretty amazing. And then whether you're with somebody or you're against somebody, you would think the record would read the same way for both sides, but it sure doesn't, does it?
Well, let me pop up with both a good morning, but maybe an apt statistical input here. The New York Times had published this morning in its print edition a survey. A poll that something like 75-76% of Republicans think the first year has gone pretty well for Trump, and 3% compared to 75% of Democrats think the same thing. And it goes to the old saying, where you stand is based on where you sit. So there's at least one poll that tabulates what you're saying.
Well, as the poet once said, a man hears what he wants to hear and disregards the rest.
Yeah, people see what they want to see, and with a psychological dimension that is both common sense, but also psychologists argue it, people don't want to admit that they were in error, So based on what their vote was, they're going to see as reality what justifies their previous position. And that's human nature, and that's what those in the kind of fact-based world or advocacy world have to deal with as we talk about these issues.
I don't... It's kind of odd for me because it's my whole career has been trading, and my brother will say, brothers very rarely say anything nice about it. They're brothers, right? Isn't that part of the deal? My brother will say that my biggest talent is if I see a trade, I'm not afraid to do it. I'm not afraid of being wrong. And a lot of traders, that was their mantra. I think this is a good one, I'm going to do it. I'm going to immediately think that I could be wrong, and I'm going to look for ways to mitigate it if I am wrong, and that the real art was not in the winners or the losers, but the ones that you could sort of drag back to even when they were a loser. That's the real talent. Nobody other than traders think like that. But if you're...
Well, that's because you've got to, on the whole, be right, or you'd be out of business. Whereas, you know, somebody... who's just got an opinion at the bar, they're not accountable. They could, in fact, remember that old Saturday Night Live skit, not to make fun of our beloved Chicago Bears, but remember the skit where they're asking the guys at the bar who's the greatest team, and, you know.
George Went and Farley, and who was the other guy?
Well, they said, oh, the Bears, the Bears.
Top Bears.
They're not accountable. Yeah. I mean, they're sitting at the bar giving their opinion.
Which would you rather have, the whole Green Bay Packer team in the 60s or a center in Ditka? Ditka.
Yeah.
Those guys, they're all dead, aren't they? George Wentz
died.
Well, it's
a long time ago.
Well, George Wentz just died. Chris Farley's dead. Who was the third guy?
Well,
I don't remember.
Can't remember.
But boy, what a great skit that was. But how do you I'm surprised kind of that the population still seems to want to respond to this. You know, our problems with the fact that we're broke are because of these Europeans not spending enough on defense. We forget the part that Britain is now second only to the Japanese, and we owe them $890 billion. I mean, how much are you going to insult somebody that is essentially floating your ass?
Well, also, there was a chart published yesterday in the Paul Krugman column that basically said we don't spend any money on Ukraine anymore. And what the chart doesn't reflect either is that a lot of defense spending is giving money to, in previous years, is giving money to countries to buy our own weapons, often our surplus weapons or outmoded weapons. And so when we're giving in previous years foreign aid to Ukraine, it's not purely to sustain democracy or oppose Russia, but it helps our U.S.-based manufacturing and industry, because we're making the stuff that we're selling to them.
Well, that was the... I don't want to go into this, because when I was at Pullman... They used, because Kellogg, which is, you know, Kellogg Brown and Root now, they were actually part of Pullman. And Kellogg designs, I think, refineries and things like that for people. And when they would go to, did a bunch in the Middle East, I don't know if it was Saudi, but while I was there, they were working on some refineries. And the people in the Treasury Department would use, I think Mellon Bank was their lead guys, they had some pretty smart guys there. They would end up going through the Import-Export Bank to get the money for, let's say it's the Saudis, it might not have been, it was over in the Middle East, get the money to finance this refinery, with the idea being the refinery is going to make money, which you know, they pretty much always do, or at least did in those days, that there's going to be a return to the company that did it, I mean Kellogg, but when a lot of the people would be hired, they'd be from over there. I don't know who the construction firm was. But at the end of the day, the U.S. would get this footing in there that people in Saudi were used to dealing with, you know, Americans, and you, maybe the guys over there would get some other business. And by the way, they would repay the money over 10 years and have themselves a refinery. There was kind of nothing wrong with it. It's actually fairly similar to what the Chinese trying to do in Venezuela, except those idiots got stiff because they didn't get the oil, where we actually got most of our dough. But I think the Import-Export Bank, when we had the big crisis, what was that, about 15 years ago? Actually, they were like loaning money to Boeing or somebody to so they could sell planes overseas, but they weren't any kind of a revenue source. They were just loaning people money to buy stuff from like Boeing and Lockheed, right? It totally changed.
Exactly. They've got a huge building on Vermont Avenue, U.S. Import-Export Bank, near the White House. And I was just giving somebody a tour, a visitor to Washington, a couple of days ago, and driving by it, and I said, there's the Import-Export Bank. It's a huge building, but I'm not sure what they're doing now because of these kind of changes, but it's definitely to get money in the hands of foreign entities that will buy U.S. stuff. So it's not giveaway. In fact, there's an element of coercion sometimes that's been documented. There's a man named John Perkins who worked in this field, and he was an economist, and he wrote a best-selling book about how they'd that he personally was involved in finagling with predictions of what benefits a loan would bring to a country so that they would then get themselves involved in loan deals to buy U.S. stuff. So it's not as straightforward as a lot of people would think.
I was just going to mention there's also another element of intrigue about the Ex-Im Bank, and Andy knows about this. One of the chairmen of the Ex-Im Export-Import Bank was a guy named Phil Merrill, who a few years ago they found him floating in the Chesapeake Bay. They claimed he committed suicide, but you know, it's a pretty tough suicide when you're found with the anchor chain around yourself and shoot yourself with a shotgun.
let me amplify on that, because that was one of my first introductions to Wayne. I was actually head of a high tech association, and for old time's sake, I'd started my career as a reporter. I'd come to the press club near my office, and one day, when this happened, shortly afterwards, Wayne said, "You went to Cornell University, didn't you?" And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Well, there's a former editor of a student newspaper, Phil Merrill, who just died." And then Wayne laid out how he was going to write a story or a column about how Merrill was the third person who had died in a canoe accident in the same part of Chesapeake Bay, and it was all sinister circumstances. And I didn't know Wayne that well then, but he laid out his evidence, as he touched on here, but he had more. And I said, "Don't write that. This is beyond, you're going to hurt your reputation." And there were
what reputation?
Yeah. And one was the former head of the CIA, William Colby, who was also a canoe enthusiast. And And I said, don't do that. But Wayne charts, as they say in canoe circles, Wayne charts his own course. So he not only wrote the story very soon after the death, but then the Washington Post basically took his story about 5 days later after the autopsy and didn't give him any credit whatsoever, even though they'd basically glommed onto it. But that's the world of the cutting-edge investigative reporter. All the work, all the risk, and no credit.
What was there? So did you go out and roll this area just to prove it was actually safe?
What that part of the bay? Well, you know, in all three cases, by the way, the first suspicion that there was another guy that was found floating with the chains around him. He had been also with the CIA. His name escapes me right now, but he was.
Now, we're not talking about the water conditions.
Yeah, his name was John Paisley, and he was Paisley was due to testify before the House Select Committee on Assassinations, particularly the JFK assassination. So, you know, in all three cases, Bill Colby, of course, was the CIA director who, in the 70s, early 70s, basically revealed a lot of the secrets because of the oversight by the Frank Church Committee in the Senate. So there were some interesting links that all three of these people that were found dead in the Chesapeake Bay had. And I'm from South Jersey. I likened it to the Pine Barrens of South Jersey, where the mob always buried their victims.
So you don't think there was a machine in the bottom of Chesapeake Bay to reach up and grab you by the ankle with a chain and pull you in?
Yeah, I think it was probably a little bit more like what the mob did in the Jersey Pinelands. But
And one of them, which may have been either rumored or reported as a suicide, and I forget which of the three, but the guy supposedly killed himself by using a rifle to shoot himself in the head while jumping up in the air so as not to get blood on the canoe. And
yeah, I think that would have been Merrill. The thing about the bay, which I talked to some people who had been involved with autopsies, is the minute a body hits water, you're already losing a lot of important evidence if you're trying to, you know, like, for example, if there's poison involved or you start to lose any sort of clues as to what the cause of death was.
Hey, quick question on this. Today the news is the Hillary and Bill contempt of Congress thing. Didn't you go through a routine explanation, Andrew, about when they do stuff like this in Congress, that they're talking about this a perjury trap? And why would they? They've already had big depositions on this a while ago, right? Or why don't you walk me through this? And what are the Clintons essentially afraid of? And I've heard the term perjury trap.
Well, because if ostensibly, and the reason that there's a power of contempt is to solve the case at hand. And in Bill Clinton's case, he's made it clear that he's glad to have all of the Epstein files released. He's got nothing to hide. He says he took four trips on the plane to Africa before he realized how bad the guy was, and when he was a donor in the presidency, didn't know how bad he was. That's the basic thing. So he says, but is this intended as a public spectacle? And that's why they don't want to testify. And you go back to the original Lewinsky type situation. where it grew into an impeachment based on here's a couple of specifics in that, and I'm not arguing the facts aside from their own state of mind, but in common parlance or understanding 30 years afterwards or so, people thought, oh, Clinton had carnal sexual relations with a 21-year-old intern, when on a more detailed look at it, it was she was a former intern, and at all relevant times she was 22 to 24, and neither Lewinsky or Clinton thought it was what they were doing was sexual relations. And so when he was asked, did you have, he said, I did not have sexual relations with that woman. That's what the impeachment was about. So in this case, if it's ostensibly about Epstein, once he's there, are they going to go through his whole history and go back 40 years to 50 years or whatever and ask all kinds of other questions and have the cameras on to talk about what he was doing at any time in his life based on a lifetime of opposition research about him? And that's to many people would think that's fundamentally unfair because it's supposed to be about Epstein. But once you're in the hot seat and people have their dossiers on what he was doing in 1975 or 85 or 95 or last year, that's a circus that can lead to new perjury charges in prison or just taking the Fifth Amendment because
which he probably doesn't want to do
the headlights, because it's supposed to be about Epstein. And we now know that despite a law that was just passed by Congress last year with every U.S. senator and all but one member of the House saying release the Epstein files except block out the names of the victims, only 1%.
Yeah, except the victims want their names in there because they want to be known as they are victims. They want something to happen to these people.
And the victims want the stuff released, not necessarily all of them. There's 1,000 of them or so. And, you know, you're never going to get unanimity, but it's not that hard to put a picture, to block out the identifying part of the victims.
So, but the idea is if for some anyway, not everybody, that if Clinton says I was on his plane 4 times, if somebody has a picture of him been stepping foot on it a 5th time, all of a sudden they're going to try and trip him up, and then that's a perjury charge.
Well, yeah, but he's probably researched that. But what the danger would be is, and by the way, Wayne and I know one of the leading opponents of Clinton and Trump, by the way, on sex allegations through the years. I'll mention the guy's name. He's somewhat controversial. He wrote a book with Roger Stone, anti-Clinton. His name is Robert Morrow. He lives in Texas. He's kind of an independent researcher. And I asked him, do you have any information out of all of your decades of research about Clinton of him being with an underage person? And the most he could come up with, Chief, was he said, well, when Clinton was governor in Arkansas in the 1970s and 80s, there's reports that sometimes he'd go to parties where there'd be high school girls. And I said, well, is that all you got? And so, you know, if somebody under the glare of the headlights is examining some party where Clinton went to the party and there are high school girls present in 1979, what does this have to do with Epstein? But it's perfectly permissible for the people who want to distract from Epstein and Trump to start asking him, well, what was the address of this party? Who was there? Who did you talk to?
Well, what do you say we go to break? We come back. I want to ask Wayne, just in terms of that level, are these guys, can they really be that clueless? I guess I don't know what the answer to that is. SP Futures up 41, NASDAQ Futures up 240. Be right back.
Listen, are you a 50-year-old person looking for term life insurance? Then you need to talk to Bob. Bob specializes in helping people find $1 million or more of term life insurance for a couple of $100 a month. Look, you need to know there's a price war in the term life insurance business, and you may be paying too much. Call Bob, and he'll shop and see how much money he can save you. Look, this could be the last term life insurance policy you ever have. Your rates are guaranteed for the next 20 years. That's right, guaranteed level rates for the next 20 years. And if you're a smoker or your health is not perfect, Bob has great rates for you too. So for $1 million of term life insurance coverage for a couple of $100 a month, call Bob right now. 800-989-1415. 800-989-1415. 800-989-1415. That's 800-989-1415. Paid for by Term Direct.
Hello, this is Tom Howe, the Chief. I think most of you know that I'm also the Chief Investment Officer at PTI Securities and Futures. There we invest for and help a wide variety of clients. And you know what? No two are the same. Some have legacy stocks, some concentration issues, some may be embedded tax issues. The others might need or want some portfolio protection. There could be estate issues or maybe new family members. The point is that we are all unique and the portfolios should match. However, the last several years have seen a relatively one-way market. It seemed that all we needed was to be all in. No protection, no fixed income, just be all in, no matter who you are or what your risk profile or age. Most management firms love that. Take this and like it, no matter who you are. Be careful with that. You are not everybody. I think most see the market view going forward as maybe different than the one looking back, so your portfolio should reflect that. Maybe it's just as simple as your life station has changed. Towards that end, we are accepting some new clients needing a more personal approach and are interested in negotiating the future and not with a portfolio designed for the past. Find me at 312-663-4310. That's 312-663-4310.
Hi, I'm Audrey Johnson, an owner of Home Source Realty and a frequent contributor to Stocks and Jocks. If you're nervous about the stock market and considering diversification, or are looking for a rate of return way better than your banks, consider adding rental properties to your portfolio. Whether it's a condo, single family, or multi-unit building, I can help you select a property that meets your financial needs. Call or text me at 708-349-3456. That's 708-349-3456. Or visit my website at myhomesourcerealty.com. That's myhomesourcerealty.com.
Stocks and jocks. Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here. Hello and welcome to Stocks and Jocks. I'm talking about Jim Lawler on the board. S&P Futures up 38 and NASDAQ Futures up 216. So we've made, I think, the full U-turn from the down the other day. Yesterday we came back maybe two-thirds of the way and probably the rest of the way back today. So we got that going for us. Over in Europe, now these guys were down. Today the DAX up 241, that's 1%, so they bounced back. FTSE up 38, which didn't go down very much, so it's not coming back very much, 0.4%. CAC around up 76, that's a full 1%. I don't know why the FTSE didn't go down or up like the other two did, but they're all kind of back to the same place. Over in Asia, the Nikkei up 914, that's almost 2%. Hang Seng up 44.1%, Shanghai up 5, call that flat. Binance, and this has been kind of the story lately, up 1 basis point, 4.26. 10-year is at, like I just said, 4.26. 30-year is up to 4.87. Those they have split apart. They were pretty even there for a long time. Now they've split apart, you know, a little significantly. I don't know what the message there is, but I think there is one. Oil down $1.07, $59.55. It was over 60. No, it's not. Brent down $1.10, $64.14. Here's the one, though, you have to watch out for. RBOB up 30, natural gas, sorry, up 34 cents, 521, up another 7%. That's because it's cold in this country. Gold, not a buck 60, still 48.35. I think it ducked over 4,900 for a minute yesterday. Silver up 62 cents, 93.25. Foreign exchange, euro is up over 117 again, 117.1, so the dollar's a little lower. British pound, 134.2. That has not gone up as much versus the dollar as the euro. So actually one of the trades might be buy the euro, sell the British pound, at least it would have been. Crypto, down 11 bucks, 89,881. Jimmy, what do you have for us? Traffic, weather, sports? Not much sports.
No, not much on the sports side, but right now on the traffic, we have from the Kennedy inbound, from the Montrose to the Jane Byrne is 30 minutes. Inbound from the Edens to Lake Cook on the Edens is now at 47 minutes. Inbound on the Eisenhower from Wolf to Jane Byrne is 45. And the inbound from the Dan Ryan to the 290 Jane Byrne is 37 minutes. In weather, if you're in Phoenix, it's 53 with a high of 75. Now, if you're in Chicago, right now it's 18 with a high of 25. And if we don't watch it, the wind chill will be about 9 below. In sports, the Bulls play tonight. And are they playing? The Bulls are playing. I guess they're not playing tonight. Give me a second here. We're playing the Timberwolves. Back to you, Chief.
Guys, I have a kind of a quick question. And, you know, Bill Clinton, obviously, did some stuff good, some stuff not so good, but how does somebody who, let's put it this way. For a brief period of time, I was on the board of the CBOE, which was a very minor spot to be, right? But if somebody would have said, hey, come out on Joe's boat tonight, and I don't know Joe very well, I'll say, why would Joe invite me? Exactly. Oh, man, it's always a good time. You get all kinds of good-looking babes. And I go, well, okay, how does Joe attract these babes? Well, he's always got the good booze. There's never a shortage of nose candy. You know, I probably would say no. I'm just saying. Now, how does a guy like Clinton, with all these people around him, not know the Maxwell and her father and all the stuff that you guys have educated us on? And how does it take him four times in that guy's plane to realize the guy's a creep? I think any one of us would have known that the minute we stepped on the thing.
I agree. But, you know, you look at all the people whose names have been mentioned in connection with Epstein, and there have been others. I mean, we can go back to Robert Maxwell, who was considered basically sort of a triple, if not maybe even a quadruple agent for various intelligence services, some of which were at loggerheads with each other. And, you see the people that are attracted to this sort of power, and, you know, I think they lose common sense when they accept invitations to these circles. And, I mean, whether it's Epstein or going back to New York in the 80s and 70s with Donald Trump and Roy Cohn. Roy Cohn was, of course, notorious for various reasons. I think they travel. They have a different mindset because they're traveling in a circle that people like us just wouldn't. First of all, we would never be invited because we're not, either politically influential or uber wealthy.
Wait a minute, Andrew went to Cornell. He might get invited.
I'm amazed. Sometimes
I went to Ole Miss. I know I'm not invited.
No, you're out. You're out.
I'm amazed sometimes when I look back at things that were going on at whether Cornell or elsewhere that I was not invited to, but I'm very happy with my existence and what I did do. I just went to my reunion, saw my friends, and last June, and three of my roommates were there, and we've got no regrets, even though we didn't we weren't. I think Cornell is one of the biggest fraternity schools, 55 fraternities, and maybe that does or doesn't include sororities. I think I only went to two fraternity parties, both my freshman year and my entire time there, much less any inner circle higher things. I have no regrets. But to get back to...
So you were not Skull and Bones?
No. Skull and Bones is 15 people from the junior class at Yale. And I went to the law school at Yale Law School. And I didn't know anything about it, even though I lived just a few blocks up the street from their headquarters. But it advanced to the present. A close friend of Wayne and mine, Chris Milligan, a book publisher, published the ultimate book on, I've got it right here, Fleshing Out Skull and Bones. And it's a list of every almost every member of this secret society. And it's fascinating. They call them secret societies for a reason. And you look on the list of, I think, 1965, and you see both John Kerry and George Bush, the future rivals for president of the United States in 2004, they're both Skull and Bones members out of 15 people in the entire United States a year are put into Skull and Bones, and two of them run for president against each other. What does that tell us? But anyway, back to Clinton and Maxwell, if I could just say that part of the explanation that we haven't yet talked on, and I'll just say a sentence or two about it, is all of these people have their legitimate fronts. So in Maxwell's case, Robert Maxwell, he was one of the most important news and magazine publishers in the world. And so it would be
What level of news are we talking? I mean, are we talking the New Yorker, or are we talking about Street Rag? I mean, we're
Street Rags, okay. but also
highly technical scientific works.
Yes. That's actually how I was just reading about that. Maybe Wayne sent me the article, but in the early 50s, what he did actually to make his start was he got into kind of academic journals. He created a publishing house that would consolidate publishing by professors in varied scientific fields. I think it was called Pergamon.
Pergamon Press, yeah.
So this is long before the internet, somebody's organizing stuff.
Yeah, he's organizing it. And so basically...
Including Soviet technical stuff that was translated from Russian to English.
So he became a linchpin in the world of both academic, technical expertise, but also intelligence expertise and diplomacy in a way. And so here's this little-known, guy from, I think it's Czechoslovakia, and he becomes the go-to guy, and then he expands into newspapers, particularly in London.
Andrew, how did he... I'm sorry, yeah. I'm always interrupting. How did he how did he do all this stuff, buy all these places? Everybody thought he was a gazillionaire. When he died, he had no dough.
No, he not only had no dough, and we talked about this on a previous show, he was more than $2 billion in debt, and everybody thought he was rich. And So if you're in politics, to go to whether it's Clinton or Clinton's counterparts in the UK, and part of his media empire was in Chicago and New York. I mean, at one point he owned the New York Daily News.
What did he own here?
I think a lot of smaller newspapers in you know, Chicagoland, let's say,
like the Orland Park, the Orland Park paper, the Evanston paper, or something.
Well, I kind of forget. I'll look it up. We can talk on a future show. I've got several books in another room on his life story, including one that was quite courageous. The UK reporter worked on it for years, and his publisher chickened out, and it almost didn't get published. Because, so if you're in politics and fundraising, you know, a wealthy newspaper publisher who wants to be around you, that, you know, obviously you're going to go to his parties, invite him to yours, get pictures with him, and particularly if you're a politician who's out of office, who doesn't have a staff trained in opposition research, or someone like Wayne who knows the backstory of all these people, yeah, you pose and go to the parties, shake hands, and the photos, and
so you're saying you could have a lot more because of the above ground activities of the dude. We could have gone to one of his parties, sipped a martini, met a few people, and walked out, and no big deal, not realizing
exactly. And if you want to take an analogy from the movies or whatever, you know, when the mob guys say, "I'm a simple olive oil importer, and I don't know what you're talking about." You remember the scenes from all these movies, or before the Senate hearings, and they said, "I just import olive oil. I don't know what you're talking about."
Well, yeah, I mean, so you don't know there's a back room where there's gambling and other stuff going. I just thought that what's his name's playing a couple of times I saw it. There seemed to be some pretty good looking young girls serving drinks and stuff. I mean, that would seem to me to be really odd right away. It's kind of creepy.
Well, it is. Actually, I've been helping somebody on a book, a victim, and it'd be a very significant book, and she's was involved in that, and has some things to say about that. But these trips were after Clinton got out of office, and he was starting the Clinton Foundation with his wife, and they were going to Africa, which is an expensive trip, and trying to give talks and raise money to fight HIV and AIDS, and taking a trip like that is expensive. And if someone says, "Well, here's an airplane, you go on the airplane to Africa," I'm not saying it's innocent, and you will wait till the book comes out and further questioning maybe of Clinton publicly at this congressional committee will be, what did you see on the airplane, just as you're saying, and that will be the legitimate area of inquiry that I and others, including most Democrats, would want to hear the answers. And that's legitimate inquiry, what you just raised.
What's this other guy they're quizzing today? The guy, is it Clark? What was this, the guy who had the wanted to bring Clinton or Trump to trial, and now there's Congress is all over him today. He's going to have a hearing.
Jack Smith.
Smith, I'm sorry.
Oh, yeah.
Well, here's the essence that he may get into, but the Justice Department, again, it's a block and a half from me as I'm talking here from my office, they want to put him in prison for investigating Trump. And his view is, okay, I'm glad to testify publicly, and here's what I'm going to say. But he's also in danger if he steps over a line and mentions something that's he shouldn't. He could go to prison himself.
What do you mean he shouldn't?
You got Jim Jordan, who's a master at just yelling at people and not letting them answer their, you know, any questions. So there's that factor too. I think he's used that way as sort of a method to intimidate and try to trap people.
But the thing is trapped, so what is the point of any of this other than cause trouble for somebody, them or him?
I well, I mean, Jordan's whole thing is he's sort of like a prosecutor during the Inquisition. I mean, he yells at people. He shouldn't even be in Congress. He's in one of the most gerrymandered districts in the country, in Ohio. By the way, I just looked up. Maxwell was right about the time he died. He was going to buy the Chicago Sun-Times. He also bought Racing Times and was going to put the headquarters of that in Chicago. So there we go.
Racing Times, is that the Racing
Forum? And back to Jordan. So he's a national wrestling champion. That's why he doesn't wear a coat. He wants to show off his muscles. And very, very pugnacious. He was an assistant wrestling coach at Ohio State when they had that big sex scandal there with predation against the wrestlers.
And one of the big funders of the medical center at Ohio State is Wexner, who was Jeffrey Epstein's sort of money man, godfather. Yeah,
it was Epstein's, is Wexner's mansion in New York. That was the headquarters for Epstein and all of his New York based.
Isn't that Wexner guy got the biggest spread in Ohio too?
Yeah, it's New Albany outside of Columbus, and Epstein bought a house there for a time.
And lived there. And the first major whistleblower, a beautiful girl named Maria Farmer, she was installed there.
I don't think he had too many dogs, Andrew.
What?
I don't think he had too many dogs hanging around.
No, and she went to the FBI in 1996 and tried to report Epstein. And of course, Wexner was there. That's where Wexner is from.
Wexner's what? He's the Gap in Victoria's Secret and stuff?
Yeah. And that includes using a lot of teenage models. So here we go. You know, the connections are there. And, you know, and this was how Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell would lure these young girls into the circle because some were, you know, out to, you know, quit school and wanted to be models, or they were runaways, and these were the ones that Ghislaine Maxwell would target because of vulnerability. Yeah.
And if we're talking about parties, I raised it as an example. Clinton, according to our friend Robert Morrow, who, you know, he did research on people like Paula Jones and Juanita Broderick, but those are older women. So what we're really talking about here is underage people. And if we're talking about the possibility that, or probability that Clinton may have gone to some parties where there are high school girls, we'll compare that to what we know, which is Trump ran teenage beauty contests and publicly bragged that he could go into the dressing room and watch them naked.
Oh, I saw some films.
He owned it.
I saw some films of those guys judging those young girls that night. You know, but this is you guys get around more than I do. I had a guy who was trading for me way back in the day in the 80s, and he ended up marrying a model, actually. terrific lady from Denmark, of all places. And and she had her pals, and we would go to Park West. Used to have a midnight thing back when we were up at midnight. We go, you know, they'd have guys spinning the records and so forth, and it was all these models. But everybody was, I think they were all, everybody was like 21-ish. I mean, they were young, but they weren't 15. Is New York? I've never really saw Illinois is not big on this, you know. I mean, generally, maybe I'm a Catholic ghetto. I don't know, but I was at a business trip in Ohio. All of a sudden, I see all these 14 or 15-year-old girls walking by in like these scantily clad leotards, and I go, "This is pretty creepy for a Saturday morning." Turns out they're having some kind of beauty pageant for girls that were like 14. I never saw anything like that. To this day, it creeps me out. Was the New York modeling scene younger than the Chicago? I mean, obviously, it's different. Here it was catalog models and things like that. Was their scene that much younger? Because here, I mean, I wasn't in the scene, but I didn't see any of that. Everybody was...
Because of the teenage magazines, so Vogue, and then you got the Gap, and, you know, these clothing outfits that catered to... teenage girls, underage teenage girls.
And Wexner was at the heart of it, but so were these modeling agencies. So there's a very clear chain of a nexus of beauty contests, modeling, and people who use models like the news media or magazines or catalogs. And many of these people who were close to Epstein and Trump are now very dead. Wayne knows the names.
There was a guy named John Casablancas, or was a guy, a French guy named Jean-Luc Brunel. He died of suicide, supposedly, in his prison cell in France.
Another big Canadian. These were people who were being investigated or named, and they ran the modeling agencies. They ran the beauty contests. And a lot of them, since immigration is in the news, the big pipeline is of Nordic-looking girls from war-torn, impoverished Eastern Europe to get these girls in desperate situation over to New York and get them involved in modeling, beauty contests, and they'd say, "Oh, well, we're having a party. There's some very wealthy people. There's some people who own modeling agencies. You should come to these parties." And we're not talking about 22-year-olds. We're talking about girls who might look like they're 17 or 18, but might be even younger.
Yeah. So what do you, this whole European thing, we only got a couple minutes, we're kind of, when it's all said and done, is everybody's going to do some more stuff in Greenland, and guys are going to start pony up some of their defense spending, which we're trying to do here, except we're broke. I was totaling up yesterday how much money these countries that we keep insulting, and we owe them all kinds of money.
Well, yeah. I mean, look at what happened. I'm sure you followed this. Look at what happened to the bond market on Monday.
Yeah.
And when it looked like there might be war between the U.S. and NATO, how did the markets react to that?
Well, isn't there a NATO thing that if somebody's attacked by somebody, the NATO members have to go after the guy. So if we attack Greenland, would we have to fight ourselves?
I guess. That's the Article 5 provision. And Trump, even during his first term, started to retrench on, well, why should we help NATO? And then he says, NATO's never done anything for us. The only time Article 5 was ever invoked was on 9/11, when every NATO country sent troops to Afghanistan and then to Iraq, which had nothing to do with 9/11, of course.
Well, if you don't know any history, you don't have to worry about it.
And by the way, one last thing with the head of NATO and the framework of a concept of a deal or whatever they called it to lower the temperature on this. As you pointed out in the earlier segment, I think, where it came up, the head of NATO is not empowered to make a deal on behalf of the European Union and all its member companies or countries. So this is rhetoric to lower the temperature, but a deal is perhaps just words to get through
Do we ever actually get a deal? We go from country to country. Do we ever actually get a deal? Do we have a deal with China? Do we have a deal with Venezuela? Do we have a deal with
exactly. This is a well-worn playbook of creating chaos. And maybe the markets react too strongly, and so people say, "Let's just say we have a deal with the details."
And the deal is that all the money Trump's making on that Venezuelan oil is going into his private bank account in Qatar.
Well, you got to have one of those.
Sure. Where do I get one though?
Next time I'll tell a story about a lady who I've known for a long time, and she was involved with the UN and some deal in Africa, and they actually had to feed like a couple of pennies for every dollar into a Swiss bank account for the guy who was a dictator. Or else they wouldn't let him do what they're trying to do. So, whatever. So, guys, don't come to Chicago this weekend. It'll be 12 below tonight or something. So you got to...
Oh, balmy!
You got to give it a while, but take care of yourselves.
Wayne's got a very warm smile, so he can bring that.
I thought it was even going to be cold down community. By you guys. It's supposed to be cold down south, too, anyway.
It's been that. It was in the 30s the other day.
SP Futures up 47, NASDAQ Futures up 259. We've made the full U-turn here. Back tomorrow, Stacks and Jacks.
This is Bob Uecker saying thanks for watching.